Evan Dawson with you live on this Friday afternoon. Connections starts right now. And our first order of business is going to be to frame the conversation locally. You just heard from Governor Cuomo on the statewide level. This morning, right here from WXXI Studios, you heard Monroe County leaders talking about plans for surge capacity, expanding capacity, and what they have essentially put together as a contingency plan to deal with a lot of different scenarios. And our Brett Dahlberg, WXXI health reporter, is on the line with us to tell us about what we're learning. Hi, Brett.
Hi, Evan.
All right. So a lot of talk for the last couple of weeks about what happens if X, then Y. What did we learn this morning?
So I think maybe the most interesting if X, then Y is if hospitals overflow here, if their capacity is overwhelmed, the county now has a plan for a field hospital locally. Now, that plan is in the really early stages. County Executive Adam Bello still has not even publicly identified the four locations that he's looking at, but he says he's going to start touring those locations this afternoon. So they've narrowed it down to four. We don't know what they are, but there are plans for what happens if our hospital systems get overwhelmed.
One message I continue to hear from the county executive and from Dr. Mendoza, Brett, is an optimism that we can continue to still bend the curve enough that we might not need the worst case scenarios, right?
Yeah, they were clear about that at the press conference this morning. They said that the extent to which they laid out this four-phase plan, three of those phases happen in a hospital, the fourth would be through the government, through the local, state, and national government, and that's the field hospital. And they said the extent to which we progress through those phases is directly proportional to the extent to which people practice the kind of aggressive social and physical distancing measures that they've been urging us to take. So if we continue to stay home as much as we can, to avoid going to public places, grocery stores, you know, that kind of sort of public gathering place as much as we can, they are hoping that we don't progress through these phases, which would mean that we don't progress to the point at which hospitals can't handle the number of patients that are coming in. They are still optimistic, though I think it's pretty fair to say that it's a very cautious optimism.
Okay, fair enough. There was also some reporting this morning, for the first time that I saw, on the number of ventilators that we currently have locally. And the one thing that I think I try to remind myself is when we see these raw numbers, it doesn't mean they're all available for COVID patients tomorrow, because there's people who need ventilators today, whether they have COVID or other conditions, right?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the reason that we have ventilators in the county is that people need them for treatment on a sort of regular basis. You know, we didn't get the ventilators that we have right now just because of COVID-19. They exist for surges. You know, we have more ventilators than we typically need on any given day in the county. But you're right, today was the first day that we got the actual numbers of how many ventilators there are from local hospital systems. So there are about 640 in the county. And I should say, I don't know if this is actually the number of ventilators or the number of patients who can be treated with a ventilator. There's been some talk in other communities in New York City and Italy and other places of splitting ventilators between multiple patients. And I don't know if the numbers that we got this morning are ventilators themselves or the number of patients that hospital systems are saying could be treated if we split ventilators between multiple patients. But the numbers we have, 640 in the county, split between the University of Rochester Medical Center, which has about 400, and Rochester Regional Health, which has about 240.
All right. Anything else that you're working on you want to let us know about before we let you go?
Sure. So I think that what we know now increasingly is that the number of ventilators and the number of intensive care units is critical to treating people with COVID-19. I talked yesterday with Paritosh Prasad. He's a doctor at Strong Memorial Hospital. He's the director of highly infectious diseases there. He said that most hospitalized patients require some sort of supplemental oxygen. So that doesn't necessarily mean a ventilator, but it often is the sort of, it's called a nasal cannula. It's the little tube that goes right up by your nose and gives some supplemental oxygen. But a lot of people have to progress past that. That is, if you get to the point at which you need some sort of supplemental oxygen, we learned this morning from Dr. Michael Apostolakis, who's the chief medical officer at Strong and Highland, that 80% of people who require some sort of supplemental oxygen end up having to move on to a ventilator. So Strong is treating 70 people with a ventilator right now. That's COVID patients and others. Mm-hmm. They have about 400 people that they could treat with a ventilator. So that number is one that's hard to change, that sort of capacity of ventilators, because these aren't just simple things that you can plug in anywhere. They require access to a certain set of infrastructure that is not super easy to build. And so that's what we're increasingly finding is really important for controlling our ability to not go past hospital capacity.
As always, Brett, thanks for the great reporting. We'll look for your work later today on our various platforms.
My pleasure. Thanks, Evan.
Brett Dahlberg is health reporter for WXXI News. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we shift our focus when we come back here. A conversation about how we disagree with one another. Can we do it better? That's next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, while COVID dominates the healthcare scene, there are still needs that millions of Americans have that will have to be met. And in particular, we're talking about colon cancer, new information, screening guidelines, and more. These are questions that so many families have, and we will address them next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I want to set a little scene for you. 2017, at a rally in Washington, D.C., where two people on very different sides of the political spectrum have taken the stage. Hawk Newsom is the founder of Black Lives Matter of Greater New York. He and his group have arrived in the National Mall on September 16, 2017, and they're calling it the mother of all rallies. They're amped and bracing for confrontation. Newsom had recently been injured at the rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, where a white nationalist hit him in the face with a rock. Tommy Hodges is also on the National Mall that day. He's organized a pro-Trump rally. As the two groups trade insults, the situation escalates quickly. Hodges recognizes that the confrontation could turn violent, and that's when he announces he'll give Newsom 2 minutes on stage to share his message with the crowd. Newsom seems ready for a fight, but then recognizes the opportunity of the moment. He says he remembers that an elderly white woman said to him in Charlottesville at the rally as he picked up a rock and got ready to throw it. She said, quote, "Your mouth is your most powerful weapon. You don't need anything but that," end quote. Newsom gets on stage and begins to share the message, describes himself as an American and a Christian whose movement is not anti-cop, it is anti-bad cop. He explains the mission of Black Lives Matter, does his best to connect with and relate to the pro-Trump audience, and it works. The crowd cheers. Social scientist Arthur Brooks shared this story in his book, Love Your Enemies. In it, he argues it's not necessary for people from different political parties or backgrounds to agree all the time. What's needed is better disagreement. In his book, he shares tips for how to do that and the impact he thinks it can have on our democracy. Professor David Primo at the University of Rochester has been teaching a course on the subject, and throughout the semester, he and his students have discussed issues related to political polarization, academic freedom, and diversity on college campuses, among other things. And several of them joining us this hour to share what they have learned. We'll also talk about how political disagreement has impacted responses to a pandemic. Joining us on the line, Professor David Primo, the Professor of Political Science and Business Administration, and the Ani and Mark Gabrielian Professor at the University of Rochester. David, welcome back to the program. How are you?
It's great to be with you.
And we've got three students of yours on the line with us, so I will say hello to a sophomore at the U of R, Madeline Candela. Madeline, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, very good. Jonah Riccinati is with us, a senior at the U of R. Hi, Jonah.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And Maggie Santacandro is a senior at the University of Rochester as well. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for having us.
All right, David, let me start with you here. So Brooks's point is that we have to stop obsessing with getting people to agree with us and start disagreeing better. Generally speaking, I know you agree, but But how do you see, how broken do you see the political landscape and the landscape of discourse right now?
So what I like to do is sort of separate the world into disagreements where the disagreements are destructive and disagreements where the disagreements are productive. And what we're seeing now is that disagreements in our society tend to be more destructive than productive. So to give you an example, you know, a destructive disagreement would be what might have happened at that rally in Washington had it gone a different way. But I think we're so focused on our destructive disagreements these days that we lose sight of the fact that disagreements can be enormously productive, that they can create innovation, that they can actually make us better as people. And I think that's part of the message of Arthur Brooks's book, is that we don't want to disagree less, we want to disagree better. And you know, we can talk a little bit about what the benefits of that might be, but I think that's a really useful distinction, this distinction between disagreeing productively and destructively.
What does that look like in a crisis like this, David?
So in a crisis like this, you sort of see that everybody has the same end goal in mind here. But there's agreement, right, that we want the coronavirus crisis to end. But where there's profound disagreement is about how best we go about doing that. One of the things I've actually been concerned about in watching the news the past couple of weeks is that those scientists and others who have questioned the aggressive response to coronavirus have been subject to threats. They have been attempts to silence them, to take away their positions. At a time like this, though, those are precisely the voices we need to hear from, because it's those disagreements that we might have with individuals who have a different perspective on how to deal with the crisis that's going to lead to a better outcome, because it's going to allow us to have a debate and a dialogue. So now is not the time to shut down controversial voices on this issue. Yes, we want to rule out clearly factually incorrect information, you know, some home remedy that's going to cure coronavirus. But we don't want to silence those scientists who are saying, hey, we need to think, and the economists, frankly, who are saying, hey, we need to think carefully about the consequences, the unintended consequences, potentially, of our aggressive response to coronavirus.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of space for a debate about what exactly is the best course of action. I think the problem, David, is that a lot of people assume that they kind of come in with an ideological lens, and they assume the other person is arguing in bad faith, that, you know, that they don't value life, or that they want everyone to suffer, or they're going to use this to politicize. And it seems broken from the start. So what's the Brooks model? If you go into a debate about what to do, what's the right amount of pullback from society, what's the right approach during a crisis like this, and you're debating with someone, or at least having a conversation, and they may have a different point of view, what's the Brooks model for figuring out a way forward that's a productive disagreement?
One idea he puts forth is that you want to try to find some area of common ground, or in some way demonstrate that you care about the same values that the other side cares about. So in the context of coronavirus, you could begin the conversation, if you're skeptical of the government's response, and say, look, I want coronavirus to end also. I care deeply about the American people, but here are some Americans who are being extremely negatively affected by the government's response. They're going to lose their jobs. They potentially won't have access to health care to deal with their own medical problems. Other people who are not as visible may die because they're not able to access health care as a result of losing their jobs. So these are, you know, this is my perspective on the issue, is what somebody could say. I'm not saying I take that position, but that's sort of the argument one could make. And by doing that, you frame it as not that away from I don't care about, you know, the elderly dying from coronavirus, toward there are other considerations here that we need to keep in mind regarding the health and welfare of other people, and that there aren't easy answers here. So you try to find a common ground around shared values.
Yeah, Brooks writes that there are certain values that might be perceived as more liberal or more conservative, but the shared kind of values would be compassion and fairness is kind of an example here. I think that's probably right, though I certainly hear a lot of people argue, well, life isn't fair. Too bad. You know, fairness is not necessarily the goal here, because you can't force fairness into life. Life isn't fair. So I'm not sure I agree with that. What do you think?
of those two, I think compassion is the one that's going to be the biggest unifier. For instance, if you start, you know, he also advises to start a conversation with a political enemy, if you will, by talking about your families. Because if you can find a common bond around the fact that you both have teenagers at home, or you both have elderly parents who you're caring for, that might be a way to humanize the other side, and again, make it easier to make a link that transcends the political disagreements. But I would tend to agree with you that of the values that he discusses, compassion is probably the one that is going to be the biggest unifier.
So I want to kick it to the students here and let our listeners know a couple of points about what Brooks is trying to do in the book here. First of all, in the book, he provides some ideas for how to disagree better, pretty specifically, and he tries to kind of base it on a number of different ideas, his own observations, research. He talked with Dr. John Gottman, who does research on marriages and what leads to divorce, and recommends that we focus on other people's distress and focus on it essentially empathically. I mean, empathy is important here. When others are upset about politics, try to listen respectfully. Try to understand their point of view before offering your own first. Never listen only for the purpose of rebutting. Listen to understand. In interactions with others, particularly in areas of disagreement, adopt the 5-to-1 rule. Make sure you offer 5 positive comments for every criticism so people don't feel so attacked or shut down. Contempt is not justified. You got to avoid contempt and go where people disagree with you and try to learn from them. Those are some of the ideas there. And then this interesting idea about sort of fake acting love and then sort of fake it till you make it. You know, if we're going to love our enemies, it's hard for people in conversations to actually show love for people who disagree deeply. And Brooks basically says, act like you do, try to make yourself act in a way if you actually love that person, and then eventually you'll start feeling it more naturally. I'm very optimistic that that's true, and I like the idea. Let me ask the students for their thoughts about what they have learned from these concepts, and I'll start with you, Madeline. What are you learning here?
So ever since I came to the University of Rochester, I had the underlying idea that maybe some of the ideas that I had or was going to put forth, especially in my classes as a political science student, would be suppressed and people would not understand how to argue with me correctly or disagree with me and have a productive conversation on these things. While I have found that true in some light, I think that this book touches upon some super important things that I have learned along the way, and as well as some other things that I had not taken into consideration before. So there was a chapter about moral arguments, and that somewhat stuck out to me. And this Brooks touches upon the idea that there are like 5 innate moral values within each person. So those are fairness, care for others, respect for authority, loyalty to one's group, and purity or sanctity. So a lot of arguments I find in the university come from people's different moral backgrounds, different moral compasses, whatever that might be. And his point that stuck with me the most was when you are debating these things with other students or whoever it may be, we need to like focus, again, my professor touched on this, but focusing our arguments on shared moral values instead of necessarily just emotion. Because you're going to find that a lot on the university setting is that people don't necessarily want to argue with you or have a productive discussion because emotions tend to take the forefront on that argument. So stepping away from this, I find that when he spoke on morals, I never even thought of this and that I needed to take a step back and find myself in a place where I can put myself in another student's shoes and think, okay, maybe they do come from a different background. Maybe they do have different morals than I do. And I think once I start realizing this more and going forward, I'm going to be able to have much better conversation with others. And I find that we've been able to do this within our small class, and people have been able to take this away a lot more and learn from each other. Just the format that we have in our classroom has enabled us to be more open with each other and hear from others that may not speak up in larger classes. So I think my greatest takeaway was definitely moral arguments and how to present those with other people.
Jonah, what are you learning?
I think there's a lot of interesting things to unpack here in context of political dialogue and discourse on a college campus. Specifically, I think in such a polarized climate, it's easy for students to kind of establish a litmus test of what types of opinions are allowed on campus. And, you know, to kind of use kind of strong arm tactics like shouting down speakers or, you know, labeling the other person as the enemy, as a bigot, in order to shut out those opinions. And Brooks kind of pushes back against that and says, you know, maybe there are some bad faith actors, but the majority of us are just Americans that have different preferences for our public policy views. And if we look at it from that perspective and think about how can we disagree with Americans in the pursuit of getting the best outcomes as a society, we're going to have a lot healthier dialogue and people are going to be happier too. And Brooks also focuses on the impact that what he calls the culture of contempt has had on the psychological health of Americans. And it's something that people, I think he quoted a study from a social scientist that said over 90% of Americans are tired of the amount of division we have within the country. And a significant amount of Americans have reported stress or unhappiness because of the amount of disagreement and division we have. And even on a psychological level, you know, when people are faced with a sort of animosity or contempt when they're disagreeing, they feel unhappy. So I think he's also arguing that we will be a much happier and much more prosperous nation if we embrace some of these values. And, you know, there are not many places better than a college campus to kind of be the testing ground for these, where we have a diverse setting of people coming from a lot of different places and traditions. And we need to really embrace not just, you know, ethnic, racial, you know, all these different types of diversity. We need to think about ideological diversity, too, and put that at the forefront of our political debate.
All right, Maggie, what have you learned?
I think Madeline touched on something that I have found very important, which is that the setting in which you're disagreeing matters. And I think this is a point that Brooks touches upon in his book as well. So on a college campus, I think a lot of times you go on social media. I'm sure all the students have experienced this, and it's just a very ugly scene. The disagreements are mean and they're nasty. And it's funny coming from that, coming into class, even the first couple weeks, there was sort of a sense that people were still kind of uncomfortable discussing this. And this is a group of students who have come in and intentionally chosen to engage with disagreement and controversial questions. So the first couple weeks, it definitely took a little bit to get out of that mode where we were scared that we were going to devolve into that sort of thing. But when we all came in and we recognized that everyone was acting in good faith and we were all working off of the same information, we had done the same readings, we had the same background, that was when the disagreements actually got very productive and I think more comfortable as well. People weren't afraid to voice other opinions, and there wasn't the idea that if you expressed a certain opinion, people would perceive you as being a bad person. So in that sense, I think that the class has sort of been a microcosm for what Brooks wants in society, this idea that people are all coming together intentionally and sort of making that effort to actually have good discussions. And I think the class has really shown that it is possible, even in the context of a college campus where we have seen some very nasty disagreements, to still, maybe things aren't as bad as we think they are.
Well, Professor Primo, let me, on the subject of contempt, I mean, your students are talking about the space that they feel and the comfort that they feel when they take this approach, as opposed to feeling attacked or feeling like things are going to devolve or get out of control, that this approach can foster more common ground, even if it doesn't lead to perfect agreement. But then when it comes to contempt, the moment we're in, I want to highlight something here. So here's a tweet from John Weaver. John Weaver is a Republican. He worked for Bush 41. He advised John McCain, John Kasich in strategy. Here's what he tweeted yesterday and has 10,000 likes and shares. Quote, I despise him. Hate isn't strong enough. People are dying because of this president's ignorance and self-love and pity. end quote. That's a Republican, and a lot of people are jumping in to basically say, Professor, I don't want to feel this strongly, but I do. I don't feel good hating somebody, but this man has botched an international crisis and people are now dying. What do you do with that contempt? Can we get through a moment like this when so many people feel this contempt, David?
Without a doubt, it's a challenge, and it starts with every individual consciously choosing to try a different path. And there's, you know, Arthur Brooks was a guest in our class earlier this week, and one of the things he and I talked about and we talked about with the class was, you know, what is exactly the reason why we want to disagree better and get rid of this contempt? Is it because it's going to lead to different policy outcomes? Arthur Brooks tends to think it might. I'm a little bit more skeptical of that. But I think where he and I agree is that it'll lead to us becoming better human beings and happier human beings, because contempt is it's a weight on you. That's where this stress comes from. That's where this anger comes from. And to the extent that you can move away from that contemptuousness toward a more positive attitude, I mean, this isn't political science. This is just, you know, this is basic mental health, right? This is the way we're going to be better human beings. And that's what I think is the most powerful message that comes out of his book, is this idea that this is going to make us better human beings to be less contemptuous. Now, how do we do that in practice? Well, it's easier said than done, especially if you spend a lot of time on social media. And I would actually single out Twitter. I actually think Facebook, allows for at least some measure of lengthy conversations, but the really short form of Twitter is just a recipe for toxicity. It dehumanizes people, and you would be surprised at the things that faculty members will say to one another on Twitter. Things I could never imagine them saying to each other's face in the context of a debate or a discussion. It's very nasty. So faculty are not immune from this either. And that says something, right, about the platform. And so I think one of the ways that you can reduce contempt is to reduce your consumption of toxic information, because that's just going to, it's sort of addictive in some sense. You mm-hmm. see it and it's fun to watch, but it's not ultimately healthy. I think Arthur Brooks uses the phrase, it's junk food for the mind.
Yeah. And I can relate. And we've all been there. I mean, certainly, you know, when you start to spiral and you feel that anger. But the reason I bring up, you know, the crisis now, Professor Primo, is because if we were to take Arthur Brooks's model here going forward, the hope is that we will at least be able to productively disagree. And by that, I mean, I think what Brooks really is arguing is, you know, we don't have to make everything a war where it's just zero sum and we blow each other up and then you win the next war. And because then it's just, you know, society doesn't gain a whole lot of progress there. We kind of get entrenched. We lose relationships. There's a breakdown of a lot of different structures. It feels right now that people are profiting off of that anger, that contempt. And it takes real leadership to try to do it a different way. Because right now, meanness, contempt, anger, they're real currency on the national scene. Do you agree?
You hit on the vital word there, and that's leadership. And one of the questions my students asked earlier this week of Arthur Brooks is that you're absolutely right. Politicians have the incentive to feed the Americans junk food, if you will, in the form of this contempt. How do you change the political incentives so that they no longer have the ability to profit from this? And that's complicated, because there's clearly an effect there. But you ultimately need politicians who are willing to potentially lose re-election, who are willing to take risks and chances and adopt a more positive message. And you also need a shift in the attitudes of the American public, that eventually they reach a tipping point where, you know, just as somebody one day wakes up and says, you know what, I'm tired of eating this junk food, I'm going to adopt a healthy diet, that they choose a different path. But it's not easy. I mean, this is why Brooks's book is so important, and this is why we struggle with this as a society. It's much easier to go to the lowest common denominator type of politics.
Yeah.
I do think there is a silver lining here, just very quickly. There is a silver lining here, and that is that the Congress of the United States is about today, if it hasn't already, while we've been speaking, is about to the House is about to pass this stimulus bill, which has been heavily debated, which people disagree about, but it passed unanimously in the Senate. So there is at least a glimmer of hope there that in a situation like this, we can come together, even though everybody can find something they don't like about this legislation. The Congress was able to function when the chips were down, when there was a crisis situation.
So let me ask your students 30 seconds apiece. Are you confident that as you, you know, sort of move through your 20s into your 30s, that you're going to grow up in a country and become, you know, sort of voting members of a public in a country that's going to disagree better? Or are you worried that we're going to be torn apart? Madeline, 30 seconds. What do you think?
I think that before it gets better, it is going to get worse as people still learn to have these productive conversations. And again, I think a lot of that comes from the overconsumption of negative social media and poor news outlets. So until people become more aware of these things, I think we are still going to struggle a bit. But as we are moving towards education, especially in universities, about these things, I think that we can progress positively.
Okay, Jonah?
I think, unfortunately, it's hard to say. While I'd like to be optimistic and think that it will get better, I think it's just uncertain at this point. But one thing that we did talk about with Arthur Brooks in our class on Monday is he talked about historically how kind of in crisis situations like this, the country can kind of come together. And that's why we do see some bipartisan action right now. So on a more optimistic note, I do hope that we will be able to, take advantage of this opportunity to come together as a nation and kind of put some of the petty bickering aside in order to actually accomplish things and move political discourse and political action forward.
All right, Maggie Santacandro.
Well, hopefully things do get better. I'm not sure, and I think one of the points Arthur Brooks made was that it's going to take action by a lot of individuals, which I think is frustrating sometimes because it feels like you're relying on a lot of things going one way for things to get better. So there's no real sign. I guess things could get better, but I'm not convinced they will immediately.
Maggie, Jonah, Madeline, thanks for your insights. Thanks for taking the time for us this hour. And David Primo, professor of political science and business administration, and the Ani and Mark Gabrielian professor at the University of Rochester. The book is Love Your Enemies by Arthur Brooks. And thanks for bringing these concepts and hanging in there and being patient, Professor. And I look forward to when we can see you in person again.
It will be wonderful. In just 5 seconds, I want to say I'm so proud of all of the students I've worked with over the past few weeks and how they've adjusted to this new environment we're in.
Well, good for them and good for you. And thanks for that hard work. I know it's been a big shift. Thanks, Professor. Thanks, students. More Connections coming up next.